Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Here's the big news so far today. Homeowners in Tacoma still don't know how bad their lead problem is. The city says 1,700 Tacoma households could be at risk, but it's unknown how many of those houses have high lead levels in their water. The culprits in the lead issue are these old connectors called lead goosenecks. They connect homes to the city's water main. The water quality manager, Chris McMean, says they're still doing testing, but they're asking concerned residents to flush their water for at least 2 minutes before drinking or cooking. Now, the utility's website tells us that the lead exposure that we all know about in Flint, Michigan, has, quote, prompted Tacoma Water to re-examine any remaining lead materials we may still have in our system. So I asked Chris McMean why it would take Flint, Michigan, to prompt re-examining lead in Tacoma's water.
So we've been operating under the federal regulatory construct, the lead and copper rule, for over 20 years. We've been testing in homes for lead. We've adjusted treatment. We've invested in treatment. So I wouldn't characterize it that we are ignoring lead or have ignored lead. We've definitely not done that. I think what we're seeing out of Flint, and not really Flint per se, that was a whole set of circumstances that didn't drive us for a variety of reasons. But what we're seeing across the water utility industry is a realization that we need to look beyond what we have believed to be adequately protected. We need to look further. And that's really what's motivated us to say, you know, we're meeting the regulation, we're providing treatment, we're doing monitoring, but is it enough? And that's really a question that I think utilities across the country are asking, and if they're responsible, they're attacking. So the testing we did at these meters, you know, certainly wasn't driven by a regulation and it wasn't required, but it was part of this quest to answer the question, are we doing all we can? Are we doing enough?
But Chris, we've always trusted you to do everything you can, that you know what it means to adequately protect us. So I still don't quite understand why this is happening now and not already, that this hasn't already been tested, these alerts about goosenecks, all this hasn't already come out.
We are certainly aware that's a perception some people are going to have. That's something that we have to attack today based on what we know today. It's an issue of understanding the science and understanding how treatment is or is not effective. We think our treatment's effective. Our testing indicates it is, but we need to be proactive and dig deeper. And that's really what we're doing.
I want to ask you about schools. Last week, Tacoma's mayor said no Tacoma public schools have these lead connectors, these lead goosenecks. So why are elementary schools now bringing in bottled water for students?
Right. So we learned about this morning as well. What the mayor said is absolutely accurate. The research we've done shows that there aren't these lead connectors to school. We know through experiences in many other utilities that schools, you know, obviously are, you know, a very important place to make sure we have these answers right. And what we've just learned this morning is that the Tacoma School District has identified some lead in some samples that they collected in the past. We don't really know much more than that, but we're anxious to learn that too. I think Seattle School District had a similar problem in earlier years, and we'll continue to support the school district if they ask us to, however we can. But we haven't been connected to that problem, and it's not the problem of the lead goosenecks.
So if a Tacoma customer doesn't know whether they're potentially affected or not, how should they find out? What are you asking people to do?
So we put up different contact approaches. One is to contact us via a web tool, call us, email us. What we're doing is researching each customer service line and trying to letting them know whether or not they're in this potential pool of 1,700 or whether they have a copper service line, which has been our standard for many, many, many years, and letting them know whether or not they're even in this pool of services to be concerned with. And we are continuing on this track of detailed monitoring so that we can better inform the results we already received and know whether or not, indeed, we do have a concern with a larger pool of homes.
Chris McMean is water quality manager in Tacoma. Tacoma Water originally tested 4 homes that showed high levels of lead in the water. The levels at these homes were at least 6 times higher than the levels where the EPA encourages utilities to take action. The connectors have been changed at these homes, and we should find out today whether this has fixed the lead problem for those households. We'll let you know. Now, in Seattle, Seattle Public Utilities says they have not found elevated lead levels at any of the 5 homes they tested over the weekend. Seattle water managers are looking at these short lead pipes called goosenecks that connect homes to the city's water main. That's after Tacoma's water company found a lead risk with those connectors. SPU says for now, you should keep flushing your taps to clear standing water as a precaution because they are not entirely sure that any of the homes they tested even have one of these gooseneck connections. They're going to keep working this week to find out. We'll let you know. This is KUOW's The Record. It's good to have you with us. I'm Bill Radke. Late last year, some Washington residents got a flyer that looked like a leftover from the election season. It had these unflattering photos of someone named Tom McCabe and accused him of embracing right-wing extremism. McCabe heads an anti-union effort at the conservative group, the Freedom Foundation, but he wasn't running for office. KUOW's law and politics reporter Amy Radel says this mailer shines a light on Washington's battle over labor unions and the lack of transparency on both sides.
The flyer attacking Tom McCabe and the extreme politics of the Freedom Foundation did say it was paid for by the Northwest Accountability Project. The address was in Seattle's Ravenna neighborhood, and I decided to look it up.
So 1037 Northeast 65th Street is the UPS store.
The address led me to a post office box inside, number 331. I asked Kevin Hamilton, a lawyer who specializes in elections, what records someone could obtain about the Northwest Accountability Project in case they want to know who's behind it.
Well, not a lot. 501c4 is a tax-exempt organization that can engage in political activity as long as it's not their primary purpose.
These advocacy groups have sprung up on both ends of the political spectrum in recent years. This group's target, the Freedom Foundation, is a nonprofit that also doesn't have to disclose its donors. The Freedom Foundation's Director of Labor Policy, Maxford Nelson, says the negative mailings were actually kind of energizing.
We were upset that they were taking a personal attack against our CEO. That doesn't really have any relevance to the work that we're doing. We'd much rather have a discussion based about the issues at hand. But, you know, it was a unifier for the folks in the office here.
Nelson took it for granted that the flyer was paid for by labor groups because the Freedom Foundation has been contacting home care and family child care providers to let them know they can opt out of paying union dues.
Well, I think the purpose of the Northwest Accountability Project is simply to harass the Freedom Foundation and intimidate our staff and our supporters and try to get us to stop doing the work that we're doing to let public employees and home care workers and child care providers know about their constitutional rights when it comes to union membership.
Their campaign has taken the form of mailings, robocalls, and knocking on at least 15,000 doors in Washington and Oregon so far. Nelson says a majority of home child care providers have opted out of the dues, but the Service Employees International Union 925 disputes that. They say nearly 90% of licensed family child care providers are union members. One of them is Shauna Murphy. She cares for 6 children at her home in Seattle's South Park neighborhood. Murphy says she hasn't necessarily had a lot of tangible results from being a union member, but she appreciates the union's advocacy on her behalf as the state rolls out new standards and ratings for child care providers. What she didn't appreciate was the canvasser from the Freedom Foundation, who she says knocked on her door one day at nap time.
I thought, who is this guy? But, you know, he definitely was presenting himself with this very official air.
Murphy says the man left without a problem when she told him she supports the union. But under state licensing rules, Murphy can't lock her door with kids there. She says she feels angry and exposed having people on her doorstep like this.
I am here all day long alone with six children, and the state publishes my address. Everyone knows that I'm here. So, you know, I am kind of out there.
She says these visits are in addition to the Freedom Foundation mailings and phone calls.
I'm obviously not interested. They don't need to send someone to my house.
Heather Weiner is the spokesperson for the Northwest Accountability Project, the group that sent the mailing attacking the Freedom Foundation. As we drove away from Murphy's home, Weiner explained the purpose of the newly formed group.
We monitor and share information on right-wing organizations.
She says labor groups formed this watchdog project to fight fire with fire. Weiner says she doesn't even know who's funding the Northwest Accountability Project, even though she works for them.
I have not asked and I have not looked. I do not know who they are, but I think it is accurate to say that we are labor-backed.
But her employer is not like the disembodied voice of the boss in Charlie's Angels. Weiner says she knows who it is, but that person doesn't want to be publicly identified. The secrecy around these groups is what led State Senator Andy Billig, a Democrat from Spokane, to try to pass a law requiring more disclosure. Billig says his efforts began years ago after a conversation with two political strategists.
When I said, if you wanted to hide money in elections, what would you do? And they said, oh, that's easy. I talked to two of them. They both gave me the same answer.
They said they'd funnel donations through nonprofit groups rather than political action committees because those nonprofits don't have to disclose their donors. Billig says the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United decision found campaign spending limits unconstitutional, so election reformers are focused on better disclosure instead.
If there aren't going to be strong limits, in all cases, then there should at least be strong transparency so people can follow the flow of money and see who is influencing or attempting to influence our elections.
Disclosing donors is constitutional. It's just politically unpopular. Billig's measure requiring nonprofits to disclose their biggest donors came close to passing the state legislature last year, only to be derailed at the last minute. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
And coming up on KUOW, you can get in on solar energy in Washington without putting panels on your roof. What's the catch? You'll find out in 15 minutes. You're listening to The Record, live tweeting at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. You can eat around the world in Seattle. We have many, many kinds of food. But when you go to some of these restaurants, be aware you might be stepping into food politics. White chefs building a reputation and making money off the food of people of color. They talked about this in a food podcast called The Sporkful, hosted by Dan Pashman. Here's part of their series called Cooking Other People's Food.
You can be white and an acclaimed chef, and you can play with other people's food. But if you are not white, if you're not an acclaimed chef, you do not, in fact, have that freedom.
This is Professor Krishnendu Rey, chair of the Food Studies Department at NYU and author of the new book, The Ethnic Restaurateur. For his book, he talked to the noted Indian chef Floyd Cardoz.
Nobody would take it seriously that he could make good new American cuisine for the longest time. They would always confine him to Indian food. You are Indian, so obviously you can do Indian food. But nobody says that in that sense to Thomas Keller. He can do almost anything he wants.
I think that it's great that someone is so interested in a culture that they really want to get to know it and to study it deeply.
This is Chitra Agrawal. She writes a food blog called ABCDs of Cooking. ABCD stands for American Born Confused Desi. Desi is a slang term for a South Asian. So Chitra likes the idea of people wanting to immerse themselves in other cultures, but she also has reservations about it that come from writing her own cookbook.
A lot of the recipes that I was writing about had a lot to do with food memory, And growing up around that food, that is an element that I don't know if someone coming from another perspective can capture.
So those are some of the issues that can come up when we cook other people's food. Then there's this.
A lot of people are bothered, and I'm sometimes bothered, when you see a lot of white Southern chefs that are kind of the face of Southern food.
This is Nicole Taylor. She's the author of the Up South Cookbook. She grew up in Athens, Georgia, lives in New York now.
Who brought, quote unquote, Southern food to the Americas? I mean, Southern food is Black food, and there are a ton of Black chefs that have the same pedigree, and they don't get any media attention.
Nicole, Chitra, and Professor Ray all agree that chefs can specialize in a cuisine they didn't grow up with and do it in a way that's really positive and respectful. Professor Ray says learning the language is a big step in the right direction. Nicole puts it this way.
I think that there are some chefs that they're not only cooking the food of other cultures, they are immersed in the culture and they're students of the culture.
When done right, Professor Ray says cooking other people's food is actually really important.
The consequences of not doing it is, in some ways, we'll be kind of ghettoized in our own culture, and I don't think that makes it a more interesting world at all. And I don't think that makes it a more equal world either.
That was Professor Krishnendu Ray, chair of NYU's Food Studies Department. One of those famous white chefs is Rick Bayless. He's built a 30-year career cooking Mexican food. He owns two successful Mexican restaurants in Chicago. You can buy his salsas at the grocery store. But he's a white guy from Oklahoma. Rick Bayless told the Sporkful podcast how he fell in love with Mexican food.
When I was 14, I convinced my folks to take a trip to Mexico City. I had taken eighth grade Spanish, so I was sure that I could be the interpreter for our group. And I made all the airline reservations, the hotel reservations. Now, why any parent would allow their 14-year-old to do this? And I did the whole itinerary for the trip. And I got to Mexico City, and I think it was about 30 minutes into it that I felt more comfortable there than I had ever felt anywhere in my life. It just seemed like I had come home.
In 1987, Bayless opened his first restaurant, Frontera Grill, in downtown Chicago. He was determined to show Americans that Mexican food is way more than tacos. Bayless says he was translating classic Mexican food for an American audience, tweaking it to make it more accessible and familiar while still preserving the soul of it. And his translations were a big hit. 2 years after opening Frontera, he opened another restaurant, and his empire has just grown from there. He's become the face of high-end Mexican food in America, but he's also faced criticism. Here's Professor Krishnendu Ray again, explaining where that criticism comes from.
I see it as a way of raging against inequality in the field.
He has mixed feelings about these kinds of translations.
What is gained in some ways is maybe subtlety, sophistication, because these are often skilled translators. You also lose some of the vernacular things that cannot be translated. I'm saying this with some amount of hesitation because I think translation is a good and an interesting thing. I'm not opposed to it. And not all translations is a colonizing act. But on the other side, all translations are also some kind of a loss.
For Bayless's part, he sees his work as just the way foods move around the world.
You ask most Mexicans about mole, which is the most revered dish in the Mexican repertoire. And they'll say, oh, it dates back millennia. It came from the pre-Columbian cultures. And then I always want to ask next, then why are 50% of the ingredients in a mole from elsewhere in the world? It just doesn't make sense. You talk about a red chili sauce, yeah, you could say that goes back for millennia. But mole is actually a fusion dish that has elements from Southeast Asia and elements from Europe blended together seamlessly with ingredients from the New World.
And so when you look at things that way, I can see how you taking Mexican food and bringing it to the U.S. and in some ways adapting it to help translate it, to use your word, to a white American audience is in keeping with the same traditions that created Mexican food in the first place. It doesn't seem like such a crazy departure. But as much as I know that there are many grandmothers who who love you like their own grandsons because of your work and your cookbooks, there are also other Mexicans and Mexican-Americans who are like, screw this guy Rick Bayless. And so how do you feel when you get that kind of reaction to your work?
Well, usually people that have that opinion of me don't want to have a conversation. Those people that say it are usually very political, and they have a mouthpiece, and they just go around saying it, and everybody thinks, oh, lots of people must believe that. And honestly, I don't think they do. I know that there have been a number of people out there that have criticized me only because of my race. Because I'm white, I can't do anything with Mexican food. Okay, so you have to stop and say, wait, is that just plain racism then?
So what is it that you think that they don't understand? Like, what's the conversation you want to have with them? What would you like to say to them?
I would just like to talk to them about Mexican food. And I would talk, and I think that within 10 minutes into a conversation, I could share my passion for promoting what I think is the greatest cuisine on the planet, and that it doesn't come from a shallow understanding of it. It comes from a very deep understanding of it. I've done everything that I could to make it my own, and I just don't even understand where they're coming from. It just sounds like sort of weird racism.
Do you think that at times in your career it has been to your advantage to be white?
I don't know the answer to that. I certainly have never thought about that. I mean, the fact that I could talk to people in a certain way, maybe that has been an advantage of mine. But still, I had to craft the words. It wasn't just because I was white that they would come to my restaurant, because restaurants fail at alarming rates. And I think probably all of our listeners know that. And to be a growing restaurant for 30 years says something that has to do a lot, I think, with the flavor of the food on the plate.
Chef Rick Bayless there, owner of two Mexican restaurants in Chicago. He was talking with Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful podcast from WNYC Studios. The Sporkful is available wherever you get your podcasts. Angela Garbez is a food writer for The Stranger here in Seattle. She thinks Rick Bayless is wrong.
So white privilege is directly tied to food.
White privilege is directly tied to food. Now, Garbez does not have a problem with white chefs who cook from a culture that's not their own. She does have a problem when they don't see the role privilege plays in their success.
Think of all the other talented Mexican chefs that are out there who came to the United States maybe as immigrants. Cooking was the one way that they could make an entrance into the American economy. But they don't have the same access to resources, say, to loans, to marketing, to audiences, to the real estate that's going to draw people in a great neighborhood that's going to draw diners in. So white chefs are at an advantage in that sense. And so you'll see it here. It plays out in Seattle. You know, we go to the International District for Chinese food or Japanese food. And we use a term that I've tried to avoid using, but it's common, which is that we say that we're going to a hole in the wall, right? Which implies a certain sort of judgment, right? That it's you're going to have to prepare yourself for something or look past something to enjoy this food. So we tend to value certain dining experiences and certain cuisines more than we value others. And those directly often correspond with race.
So what would you want a white chef who wants to cook, well, what isn't ethnic food, you know, who wants to cook a food identified with far shores,
right.
or south of the border, what do you want one of those white chefs to do with the fact that they have white privilege?
I mean, at this point, I think acknowledging it is really the most important thing. Because what else, maybe from there we can have a conversation that leads to how can we make it so that we can direct more resources to minority-owned businesses? How can we raise the profile of other chefs? So I just interviewed Jerry Tronfeld, who is one of Seattle's and one of the Pacific Northwest's most revered chefs. He cooked at the Herb Farm, which really defined fine dining in this region for decades. And he has two restaurants here in Seattle. One is called Poppy, and he makes very much his food there. It's seasonal Northwest ingredients with herbs, but a lot of the inspiration comes from India. He just opened a restaurant last summer called Lionhead, in which he's cooking fairly traditional Sichuanese cuisine. He spent time traveling in China, and he did research there. Acknowledging white privilege doesn't necessarily mean, hey, look at me, like, I totally had a super big advantage over all of you. You know, and it's also, we shouldn't think that acknowledging privilege takes away from the hard work and the careful study that you've done. I think that many chefs, any chef who's worth his salt, his or her salt, is doing that research and wants to understand where the food is coming from. But I think what you can do there, when I talked to Jerry, what he was very quick to say was, you know, I'm not an expert. I like cooking this food and I'm learning all the time. And he was very quick to praise and give credit to his sous chef and his chef de cuisine. Their names are Kenny Lee and Sean Lin. And he said, they have taught me things about Chinese technique that I would never have learned in a book that is really valuable. And he learns from them every day. So
I ask you because I feel like part of this conversation has gotten reduced to, oh, it's not okay for a white guy to cook Mexican food, to cook?
That's the question that I often get, or that's the reaction that I get to some of the thoughts that I put forward and to what I'm writing, and I'll just say it here really clearly. It's fine. I don't care what you cook. Chefs are creative, curious people. For many diners, they're, you know, I'm sure Jerry Tronfeld is introducing people in Seattle to Sichuan food, possibly for the first time, right? That's very important. It's great. You know, so they're in some ways cultural ambassadors, right? But so there's responsibility that goes along with that. As we become a more diverse culture, we've always been diverse, but as we get more diverse and as people are more aware and as people want to talk about these issues more, it behooves you to be able to speak about that, to be able to acknowledge it. I mean, if we're working towards a more equitable society, which I would like to think that all of our listeners out there want that, you can't move towards that unless you can talk about it. And that's really where I think Rick Bayless failed, to not even be able to acknowledge it. Then there's no conversation that can be had.
Angela Garbez, a food writer for The Stranger. Tomorrow, we're going to hear from local chef Eduardo Jordan of the restaurant Solare. He grew up in the South, but he didn't think he'd be able to make a name for himself in the restaurant business by cooking his own food. That's tomorrow. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Let me guess, you're a fan of solar energy, and you don't have any solar panels. That's most people. Maybe you don't have the right roof for it, but you might be able to buy into a bigger, centrally located project. These are called shared solar or community solar. There's a boomlet of these kind of projects in Washington State, while there are hardly any in sunnier Oregon and Idaho. But as KUOW's Tom Bonsi tells us, Washington's generous solar incentives are now coming under scrutiny.
Single mother Chris Anderson says she looked into adding some kind of renewable energy to her home in Shelton, Washington, but it was daunting. Then last year, the electric company in her area invited customers to invest in a shared solar array on the roof of the utility's operations center.
This opportunity is easy. I mean, it's literally the easy button. Okay, here's my check. But I'm doing a good thing.
Anderson is one of thousands of people around the Northwest who've bought shares in a community solar project developed either by their utility or a local nonprofit. Justin Holsgrove of Mason County Public Utility District Number 3 leads me onto the roof to see the project Anderson and her friends bought into.
So, glad you brought your sunglasses. It's nice and bright up here, which is perfect for solar.
Holsgrove says his utility and others around the state had to turn people away.
We had twice as many people register for solar units than we had solar units available. So there was a lot of interest in this.
And then what kind of payback period did you promise investors?
Yeah, so we promised a 3 to 4 year payback period. We estimated, probably a better word, we estimated a 3 to 4 year payback period, which is fantastic. When you're looking at putting a rooftop solar system on your own home, a private home, you're looking at a 10 to 15, maybe even a 20-year payback period, depending on, you know, your site's location.
This community solar project offered customers an unusual combination of low risk and high reward, plus none of the hassles of building or maintaining a residential solar array. It pays back like this. The utility pays you for your share of the electricity produced, usually as a credit on your bill. In addition, Washington State gives utilities a tax break to incentivize green energy, and the utility passes all of that through to its solar customers. Holsgrove says the state subsidy is many multiples greater than the value of the electricity generated.
With community solar, the state production incentives that are available really makes it lucrative to get into it.
It's probably no coincidence there are more than 50 of these community solar projects registered in Washington State compared to just a handful in sunnier Oregon and Idaho. They have no state incentives for shared solar. The going rate for electricity is cheap in the Northwest, so the pioneering shared solar projects in Oregon that rely on power revenue alone may never fully pay back their participants. In Washington State, there's a catch, isn't there always? The program is too popular. A surge in solar installations is pushing more than a dozen Washington utilities up to a cap on incentive payouts. Solar installer Jeremy Smithson of Seattle supported a proposed overhaul of the incentives at the legislature, raising the cap but lowering the subsidy payments to future solar adopters. It didn't pass. So big Washington utilities are notifying solar array owners their annual checks could be reduced because their programs are oversubscribed.
For most people, it's just going to take longer, you know, for that project to pencil out. We do have some people who took out loans, and they were counting on the incentives to help them make the payments.
Separately, an analyst at the conservative-leaning Washington Policy Center think tank criticizes the solar subsidies as an extremely expensive way to make the Northwest's already pretty clean power generation a tiny bit greener. But the legislature ignored that critique in favor of spurring a local solar industry. I'm Tom Bonsi in Shelton, Washington.
You're listening to KUOW Seattle, and if you missed any of this show, you didn't, because you'll find podcasts of KUOW shows and news reports on your favorite podcast app or at KUOW.org. Thanks for tuning in. In 2009, Lisa Hallett's life was ripped apart. She was at a military family meeting at Joint Base Lewis-McChord when she felt a tap on her shoulder. She remembers a long walk across a parade field and two men in green suits.
The gentleman on the right, he had a white piece of paper and he read it. And he reads, "The Secretary of Defense regrets to inform you that your husband, Captain John L. Hallett, is believed to have perished in the fires." And I stopped listening. And so many words in there, you can't erase, perished, fires. But the most important word was believed.
Lisa Hallett held on to that word, believed, for as long as she could. But she couldn't escape the reality. Her husband had been killed in Afghanistan, and she had been left with a 3-year-old, a 1-year-old, and a newborn baby that her husband would never meet. Hallett had to find a space where she could grieve without being consumed by her grief. She found that space in running. And she told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel why running was the right way for her to process her loss.
My children have made this immense sacrifice, and they have lost their father to war. and it is not fair for them to lose their mother to grief. And John didn't die so that we can be the ghosts, right? We just got to celebrate life. But I still need that space to remember John. And I still need that space to celebrate his life. And I still need that space to share his stories and to hear his stories. And running is the framework. I can live this life moving forward and building a new life that is inspired by who John was and what we built as a family. And the run gives me the space to feel comfortable and confident in that process so that I can remember, I can be inspired, and I can let those daydreams of the past not be something that breaks my heart, but like feeds me.
What did that look like when you finally found that space for yourself to be able to come to terms with this loss, as you said?
I would take the first few miles and I'm just trying to escape the day-to-day chaos of three young children. So the first mile is, oh my God, the babies didn't stop crying for the last hour and a half. And then the second mile is, oh, I need to buy diapers. What am I going to make for dinner? There's baby food stuck in the carpet. What am I going to do? And then you keep moving on. But then three and four and mile five, all of a sudden, the busyness and the high energy of that day-to-day life with young children, it starts to quiet down. And then maybe mile five, it's just quiet. There's nothing. And then mile six, it's, oh, my husband died. And that raw candor with myself that's forcing me to face and understand that John doesn't get to come home. We don't get our best friend back, our father, my husband. It was a new, hollow feeling, and I was so afraid that I would never know joy again. But then processing that for a few miles, just being vulnerable and broken for a little bit. But what's so fantastic about a run is that you have the space to hit that brokenness, but then to rally and then continue to move forward. So then mile six and sevens, it's that deep breath. Okay, I've already accomplished 6 miles. What am I already accomplishing in my real life day to day? And understanding I can do this. It's not what I wanted. It's not going to look pretty, but I can do this. And then keep moving forward. And then by the end of the run, I'm feeling stronger, a little tougher, a little bit fiercer, and just confident that I can raise my children and that I can live a life that was worth John's sacrifice.
Well, and as part of this discovery, what running did for you, what it gave you, you started a whole organization around it. It's called Wear Blue, Run to Remember. Why did you start that organization?
In the year John deployed, 41 soldiers were killed in combat. And on the home soil, we had a community of spouses and families that were grieving. They were grieving the loss. They were fearful of what was to come and how their families would be impacted. And it was a very overwhelming time. And several women in the unit, Erin O'Connor, Alice Pope, recognized the power of running. And Erin and myself really felt this need to gather the community together. And we recognized that we needed something healthy, right? If it's pooling our spirits and giving us the strength that we need, how can we take this activity and pair it with what the gift of community can give and create a support network that can help our families? And it was never this grand plan to make something magnificent. It was born of a deep desire to survive a really difficult situation. And we met for the first time in a Burger King parking lot, kind of looked at each other, and then we ran around the airfield. But then it continued. We showed up again the next Saturday, and this time we called out the names of those men who we had lost. And then we ran around the airfield again. And sometimes there were three of us looking at each other, and sometimes there were 15 of us. But slowly, as we met every week, our steps really became transformative in how we dealt with the deployment. It gave us a new avenue to deal with these hardships and all that grief and frustration and confusion that we were feeling. It gave us a place to remember, and it gave us the strength to recognize that we weren't facing this alone. I think everything's scarier when you think you're doing it all by yourself, but then you realize that you really have a family and a community to carry you on your steps forward that's also trying to figure out how to navigate this deployment. this started as three of you meeting in a Burger King parking lot and going for runs together. But there are now people around the country who come together. They call out the names of the people they lost, and then they run together. What do people who are now involved with this organization you started, what do they tell you about how running helps them?
I have been astounded by the stories that I've heard in Wear Blue from men and women who faced their own losses and chosen to move forward in a healthy and life-affirming way. But I love thinking about a couple in Georgia who didn't have words after a difficult deployment, didn't know how to reintegrate, and found that in the steps of a run, they were able to literally and figuratively start to find the common ground to build their lives back together after a difficult deployment and learning how to come back together as a family.
Lisa, we've talked so much about what your life looked like and what you thought it would be in 2009 and then what it looks like and what it is today. How do you think the you of today is different from the you of 2009?
I think about that a lot. How would my life be different if John hadn't died? And it would be very different. But I hope that I am different now, in that I am less vanilla, more rocky road. And, you know, when I was married to John, I wanted 2.2 kids and a white picket fence, and I wanted things to be real, clean, and safe, and expected, and that is not life, and it's never going to be life. And so I think that the me of today, I hope, understands that it's not the changes that affect us, it's how we face those changes and how we deal with them and how we envelop resilience in our day-to-day life that's going to empower us to be more successful. And I think that these past 6.5 years have given me the gift of perspective and resilience and, I guess, self-love to understand that it's not going to be 2.2 kids in a white picket fence, and that's okay. And that I'm more rocky road, I'm a little bit grittier, but I think that makes me more interesting and more poised to be a person who can change my community, my family, maybe the world.
That's Lisa Hallett. Her husband was killed in Afghanistan in 2009. She turned to running to help her grieve and co-founded Wear Blue, Run to Remember. That organization's now got 15,000 members across the country, and you can find out more about it and how you might get involved at KUOW.org. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. How did Microsoft miss the mobile revolution? Does it baffle you how a company that seems to have all the advantages, a market dominator, can blow it? Well, here we go again, maybe. Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton. Hi, John. Welcome back.
Hey, Bill.
This time it's not Microsoft, though. In fact, Microsoft looks pretty good in this comparison. The news is that Intel is cutting its workforce by 12,000 people, including in the Seattle area.
It is. We learned today that it's closing its offices in DuPont, which is down around Tacoma, and that's about 350 jobs. It's also been reported that, although not confirmed, that a Bellevue office will be closed. But this is very big job cuts for Intel.
Yeah, 12,000 people, and it must be a big blow to Portland and Oregon.
Well, it's Oregon's largest private sector employer, and Oregon has given Intel $100 billion worth of tax incentives over 30 years to keep its operations down there.
Sound familiar?
It's not tied to how many jobs it creates.
Yeah, how about that, Boeing? So why is Intel cutting so many positions?
There's not one simple answer, but if we have to boil it all down very quickly, Intel did miss the switch over to devices and smartphones and things like that, much like Microsoft. It spent about a decade trying to catch up.
For those who don't know, I just want to say Intel was dominant in – they made the chips
well,
in PCs, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And they're still dominant in PCs and laptops, but fewer of those are being sold. And so that's where it's starting to pinch. And so they're trying to make the transition into data centers and the cloud and wearable devices. But another thing that complicates things for Intel, as opposed to Microsoft, is that to make these chips, and they make them here in the United States as well as other places, these fabs or fabrication factories are enormously costly. They take huge upfront costs. And to get them back, Intel has to make a lot of good chips that people are willing to buy. And as PCs decline in sales, that's a big problem. The other thing is that Moore's Law, named after Gordon Moore, one of the co-founders of Intel, which talked about the exponential increase in computing power every few years, has begun to slow down. So it's taking more time to get the oomph in the next generation of chips, and that's another thing that's hurting Intel.
So going back to my Microsoft question, you and I were talking about this. How does a market dominator, you'd think that they are savvy enough to keep milking that cow, but also have a very sophisticated team looking for the next big thing. Why do giants keep stumbling?
Well, because giants love to milk the cow, and Wall Street wants them to milk the cow. Wall Street doesn't give them incentives to go find other animals to harvest or whatever. And so I'm sure there were smart people in Microsoft saying, hey, this thing is coming down the pike, but moving through a big bureaucracy is very hard. And remember, 10 years ago, who would have thought that we would have what an iPhone can do now. I mean, it has more computing power than the computers on Apollo 11. In Intel's case, where they make the chips, they're not huge and diversified like Microsoft. The cost of missing this was much more consequential. Now, let's emphasize that Intel is very, very financially sound. They make a ton of money, just like Microsoft. And so they have a chance to ride this out, but I'm sure Wall Street's happy. Wall Street loves it when you kill jobs.
How happy is Wall Street with Microsoft these days? It seems like they've caught that wave that we call the cloud.
Wall Street's happy. Microsoft killed some jobs, so wouldn't that please Wall Street? But I think that Wall Street is very satisfied with Nardella's stewardship of the company, and the company is moving ahead on a host of fronts. But uneasy rests the crown, so any market dominator, any huge company like Microsoft or Amazon needs to watch its back.
So finally, what is the thing that's going to swamp the cloud, destroy Amazon and Microsoft, and leave Seattle's economy a smoking rubble heap?
Well, a war with China would do it. I think that in general, we have to watch out for being overly dependent on any one thing. Seattle is a very diversified economy, and it punches well above its weight. We attract talent and capital. We have to keep doing that.
Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton, always good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
On the Record on KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. Do get our podcast on your favorite podcast app or at KUOW.org.